You are tuned in to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, everyone, and a very warm welcome back to another amazing show on a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am the Zany Mystic, also known as Lance White. First, before we start the show, I'd like to thank my friend Jessica Mystic, the Crystal Child, for helping me to contact tonight's guest, Andrew D. Bajago, whom I'm honored to have as my guest tonight. I highly recommend Jessica's amazing 39-part YouTube interview with Andrew, which can be found on her video channel, Jessica Mystic, numeral 1. About Andrew. Andrew is an American trial lawyer, writer, and environmental scholar. He was born on September 18, 1961, in Morristown, New Jersey, the youngest of five children, and grew up in New Jersey and California. Andy was one of the whiz kids who served from 1969 to 1972 in DARPA's Time Space Exploration Program, Project Pegasus, which we'll be focusing on tonight. A past member of Mensa, the High IQ Society, he holds 5 degrees, including a BA in History from UCLA and a Master of Philosophy from the University of Cambridge. While an undergraduate at UCLA, Andy became a journalist and protege of editor Norman Cousins of the Saturday Review, who once compared him to Robert Hutchins, and nominated him to be the editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He was inspired by a meeting with architect Buckminster Fuller in 1981 to pursue a career in environmental policy. After their meeting, Fuller wrote, "Andrew Bajago's integrity augurs well for humanity's continuance in the universe." Now, I don't want to get ahead of the show by sharing Andrew's fascinating background, so let's welcome him to the show now, so he can speak for himself. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Hi, Lance. Good to be with you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. When I heard your incredible interview, well, it was first with on Jim Gillen's show that comes after mine. I believe Brooks Agnew interviewed you, and I was just spellbound by the information. And then Jessica was nice enough to help me contact you. So I'm thrilled to have you on tonight.
Right. Well, I'm happy to be here and to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Well, let's just delve right into it. First of all, you were a member of Project Pegasus, and this was in the year. This was around 1967, 1968, when you were first inducted into Project Pegasus. Could you tell us what that project was about and your role there?
Right. Project Pegasus was a classified research and development program of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which when I was unofficially brought into it in 1967 as a six-year-old, and then even still when I was officially brought into it in the fall of 1969 as a child of age 7 going on age 8, was alternatively ARPA and DARPA during those years. Mm-hmm. And what Project Pegasus was essentially the real Philadelphia experiment. It was the actual U.S. government program in which different forms of quantum access had either been developed and were being tested on civilians or were under development. And by quantum access, I mean everything from conventional remote viewing for the U.S. military all the way to physical time travel through Tesla-based teleporters and devices that were called Stargates, just as they have been called later in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first experience in time travel occurred in 1967-68 when my late father, Raymond F. Bajago, who was an engineer for the Ralph Ann Parsons Company, essentially with reporting requirements to the CIA. He had worked on a number of classified aerospace projects in the 50s and 60s, including the ramjet engine project at Curtiss-Wright Aeronautical, and the B-70, which was the atomic-equipped strategic bomber when he was at the Thomas A. Edison Research Labs in West Orange, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was six, he took me up to Building 68 at Curtiss Wright. And there on the shop floor was a device unlike anything I'd ever seen before, and unlike what most people have been permitted to see.
Yeah.
It was essentially two parenthesis-shaped objects on the floor that were about 8 feet tall and about 10 feet across, and they propagated an energy field that sort of looked like water falling in a public water sculpture. They had sort of a flowing quality.
Uh-huh.
But when you walked up to the energy field, you could see that it looked like raster on a black and white TV screen, and you could see little blue-green squiggles going across that field of energy.
Mm.
And as my father explained, we were going to hold hands, and we were going to leap through that energy field.
Wow.
And I should prepare for that, because when we did, we would find ourselves in this tunnel. And then we would suddenly pop into view on a hillside somewhere west. He didn't tell me where we were going, but, you know, elsewhere in the country. So that when we arrived there, we might be split up in the tunnel from Woodbridge, New Jersey, to where we were going. So he just advised me to just stay where you arrive. Well, where we were going is where we would be going for the next 5 years when I was attached to Project Pegasus as one of the child participants. The teleporter at Curtiss Wright was opening up a vortal tunnel that was literally going through time rather than across time.
Wow.
It was propagating what was once described by Jack Pruitt, one of the project facilitators, one of the team leaders on Project Pegasus. It was opening up an interstitial chasm in the fabric of the time-space continuum.
My goodness.
And rather than being digitized at our point of embarkation and then reassembled, you know, reintegrated at our destination, as was being depicted on Star Trek. The opposite was happening. The universe was being opened up, and we were passing through it. Okay.
Wow.
Now, where we were going and where we would go for the next 5 years was the state capitol complex in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Santa Fe was being used as one of the nodal points in this teleportation network for the same reason New Jersey was, which was that it was a very old, settled area of the country. So if a quantum mishap occurred and we were lost in time, there would be people there going back hundreds of years who could help us and, you know, help us survive if we unfortunately got lost in time.
Mm-hmm.
They were also using Santa Fe because it's a small integrated city, very walkable. And during the early years of teleportation development by the U.S. government, they couldn't tune the device to put somebody down precisely where they wanted. They were trying to put us down on one side of the Bataan Memorial Building in Santa Fe, which was the pre-1966 state capitol building, before the roundhouse was built. And so that was their goal, but frequently we would pop into view somewhere else in Santa Fe and have to walk to that area. And so that became sort of a mainstay of my project activities because they were using this form of quantum leaping to New Mexico to involve us in time travel research and development activities in New Mexico and then return us from the an identical teleporter at the Sandia National Labs outside Albuquerque back to the tarmac at Curtiss Wright with an adjustment in time. We would be put back in New Jersey about an hour of the day we had left. So during those, especially those 3 years, beginning in fall of 69, we were jumping to Santa Fe, doing things in New Mexico that sometimes lasted days, weeks, and even months. In fact, during those 3 years, I spent 4 summers in New Mexico.
Wow.
And then we would jump back to New Jersey, arriving on the day we left, effectively erasing what we had done in New Mexico, at least make it difficult to search.
Mm.
But search as I might, during the last 10 years, during my quiet hours from taking, you know, stolen away from my law practice, I've spent thousands of hours and thousands of dollars and driven thousands of miles, and I have essentially reassembled an insider's account of Project Pegasus. I now have hundreds of facts that relate to what happened in this project during the early years of time-space exploration by the United States government.
Wow.
So on one track, I'm going back, and I'm sort of on the deep political track. I'm exploring what happened in Project Pegasus, the people, the places, the technologies, and the events, because this was a hidden enterprise in the history of science that I think now not only deserves to be told, but needs to be told, because I'm of the opinion as an environmental scholar that if we're going to create a sustainable human society on Earth, we may have to move to teleportation, at least for our long-distance civilian transportation. Mm-hmm. Because if, for example, teleportation had been implemented globally when it emerged in America's defense labs 40 years ago, mm-hmm. we would have kept billions of tons of air pollutants out of the global atmosphere. Mm. And now we're confronted by a global warming problem that, whether it comes from natural or human causes or some combination thereof, mm-hmm. is still a serious threat to our civilization. I think scientists are almost unanimous in that opinion at this point. So I'm speaking out because I want to create the pretext in which teleportation can be declassified and used at a minimum to replace conventional air travel by airplanes. Now, there was another component. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. The other major technical focus of Project Pegasus derived not from the works of Nikola Tesla. And by the way, Tesla's papers had been sent to the Los Alamos physics community at the time of his death. They were never lost. They've been at the Los Alamos National Lab since 1943-44, when the world's leading physicists were gathering there to build the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. But another major focus of the development of this quantum access capability by the U.S. government, a capability that it was hoped would give America's president and its other executive branch officials data derived from remote sensing and time. In other words, it would provide information about the past and future that could be used for logistical planning, for contingency mm-hmm. planning by the president and the military and so forth. Mm-hmm. The other major emphasis derived from the works of two Vatican musicologists named Ernetti and Gemelli. In the 1940s, they were studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants to try to figure out why Gregorian chants are so healing, have such healing potential. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to split the voices within the Gregorian chants and study them. And they were developing a specialized microphone to do that. And to their astonishment, something that Gemelli's father had said to him when he was a child came through the microphone. And so Ernetti and Gemelli approached the most distinguished Italian scientist of that time, not just physicist, but scientist, Enrico Fermi. And by 1952, Ernetti, Gemelli, Fermi, and others that they brought inside their team there, centered at the Catholic University of Milan, had developed a device called a chronovisor that can locate and amplify the signal of a past event. In fact, by 1952, Ernetti claimed for the rest of his life, until he died in 1994, that by 1952 they had a second-dimensional chronovision image of the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth.
Wow.
In fact, I was a child in Pegasus. I was permitted to witness about a 20-second documentary, which was a filming
of
a hologram in which the crucifixion was being seen. So chronovision evolved in the intervening years between 1952 and when I found myself in Project Pegasus under DARPA, beginning rigorously there in the fall of 69, mm-hmm. to where it had been modeled in a three-dimensional space so that it was essentially a hologram propagating device where if you were standing outside the hologram, you could look at this cubical form of cinema and see something going on in the past or future. However, if you stood on the stage of the chronovisor when the hologram was propagated around you, you experienced a form of virtual time travel. So another major part of my activities as a child participant in Project Pegasus involved chronovisor probes, which were undertaken both in New Jersey during hidden parts of my schooling there in the third, fourth, and fifth grade, but also during some of the time loops that we spent in New Mexico after teleporting there.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were the two major emphases of Project Pegasus. Obviously, teleportation has great potential on the civilian transportation front. Chronovision presents sort of a danger and opportunity. The danger is that it essentially jeopardizes everybody's privacy, the privacy of everybody who has lived, alive, or may one day live. The opportunity is, imagine if you could go to the National Gallery or the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and watch a 40 by 20 foot screen or a 20 by 20 foot cube of light in which a famous historical event from the past was being portrayed.
Wow.
That potential, for example, to inspire the next generation of young people about history is also a secret technical capability of the U.S. government that has been possible since 1970.
Wow.
I mean, so I've gone from age 7 to now I'm 47, knowing about this fact. And at this point, I think now that two generations have passed, it's time to really tell the American people and the people of the world the truth, and that is that these technologies exist and that the U.S. government decided to keep them secret 40 years ago, notwithstanding the tremendous potential they hold to advantage all of humanity.
I totally agree with you on that. Are there any repercussions to your sharing this information at this time?
I think there are. Certainly, the project principals were concerned about speaking out because they've been threatened that they would be killed and also that their family members would be killed.
Mm-hmm.
I was warned by a representative of the executive office of the president during the first George W. Bush administration in a meeting mm-hmm. that was held in Colorado during one of my fact-finding trips, that if I continue to research, write about, or speak about my experiences in Project Pegasus, which mm-hmm. concern secret technologies and sensitive national security matters that were to remain secret, they quote-unquote couldn't guarantee my survival.
Mm-hmm.
But more recently, I had essentially covert meetings that resulted from the CIA and the NSA directing personnel towards me covertly,
mm-hmm.
putatively as clients of my law practice. In other words, they had people approach me posing as people in need of legal services, who I then became the lawyer for, and several of them basically briefed me on the fact that certainly here during the Obama administration, I was going to be green-lighted and they wouldn't retaliate against me if I now stepped forward
and described
my experiences in Project Pegasus and essentially the consequences of the fact that the U.S. government developed this quantum access capability 40 years ago. So my understanding now is that I'm free to speak. And I've also decided not to live in fear. I mean,
I've experienced
a lot, I've had a good life, and I don't want to cling greedily to life and in
right.
the process avoid fulfilling my destiny. So I've just decided to put fear behind me and move forward courageously with my campaign to bring these truths to the people of our planet.
Well, you certainly have my deepest appreciation and admiration for what you're doing, because you're certainly on the forefront of probably the beginning of a wave of people that will start coming out and sharing what they know, which, as you said, it's time and it's necessary. Aren't there implications with going back? There's so many questions it brings up into the past that... For instance, events that maybe didn't happen the way that they're written in the history books. And when you're actually there in live time, does that affect the timeline that you're participating in, or are you kind of holographically superimposed on it?
Well, that's a complex question, and it's a very good one. And I think it goes to the different forms of devices or quantum access technologies that they were working with and what their effects were. The chronovisors were essentially fields of supercharged particles.
Mm-hmm.
The chronovisor was essentially propagating a hologram that was a dense field of supercharged particles,
mm-hmm.
where we were essentially being superimposed superluminally over a past or present environment.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were told, and I had interactions with people in the places we were sent to. In other words, we could interact with and be seen by the people in those locations.
Wow.
But again, as Jack Pruitt described, when he trained us on the chronovisor at Morristown, New Jersey, which is in fact my place of birth, there was an old building undergoing historical redevelopment there, and they put one of the chronovisor arrays in there, that we were merely a spectral presence in the past and future events we were being sent to.
Right.
So with chronovision, there was no danger of either, of let's say, affecting the past and then coming back and finding yourself in an alternate present.
Right.
The so-called butterfly effect.
Yeah.
When we were teleporting, we were being physically sent there. And
okay.
so there was that danger implied by, you know, the problem of Schrodinger's cat,
yeah.
that if we were sent somewhere and we changed one of the preconditions of where we came from, the old, you know, what would happen if you went back and killed your grandfather problem.
Right.
They were concerned enough about that to instruct us, basically, when you're actually physically time traveling, try as much as possible to honor the prime directive and not alter the conditions of the times that we're sending me to.
There was a lot of integrity.
Yeah, there was a lot of integrity in this project. And they were also doing things where they were sending us to parts of the country where there wouldn't be an overlap. For example,
right.
you know, it was in the heart of the Southwest where I wasn't likely, let's say, to vacation with my family during, let's say, the second summer of 1971 by going, you know, back to seeing myself doing things during the first summer of 1971.
Wow.
So that control for some of the quantum paradoxes that time travel implies. But I don't know of any serious problem that resulted from somebody doing something when they were time traveling. I think that's more of a theoretical consideration than a practical one.
Now, what's the furthest into the future that you were able to go to as far as our planet is concerned? I think you went to 2013, didn't you?
We went in a form of virtual time travel through a chronovisor array that was at the ITT Defense Communications building in Nutley, New Jersey, which was adjacent to the Defense Logistics Agency, so it was involved in mapping the future for the U.S. military. We went superluminally on a technical remote viewing exercise to view the condition of the U.S. Supreme Court building in the year 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And what I reported to the Naval Intelligence Officer, the Lieutenant Commander in the Navy who debriefed me after that probe, was that I saw the building under about 100 feet of brackish water. So at least on that timeline, there had been some ecological or other catastrophe where Washington, D.C. and the East Coast of the United States was under a lot of water. But, of course, we know from my experiences in Project Pegasus that the multiverse exists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reason they shut down time travel to the past, for example, was because when they sent the same kid or another kid to the same event in the past, it always changed a little bit. So we don't know, based on that probe via Chronovision, whether that discrete future will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, and again, that was just virtual time travel where we were viewing what was there. Now, later in the program, they developed these much larger devices. I mean, the thing at Curtis Wright was just a little bit higher than an adult human being.
Mm-hmm.
But during the summer of 1972, they constructed this huge device on a basketball court at the Cultural Center in Cerrillos, New Mexico. It was an old YWCA facility with a huge full court, you know, basketball court. And they built this huge 40 or 50 foot device. They were referring it to it as a Stargate. And what we were doing as kids is we were running up this ramp and jumping through the doorway that was filled with densely neon blue light, and we were teleporting forward to the year 2045.
Wow.
And we would then go into a building there, get data from the project personnel in 2045. We would then be taken to a conference room where they were having us jump through the wall because by 2045, the teleports were actually recessed into the building.
Wow.
And we would pop into view. We would then have one of these mortal tunnel experiences, and we would pop back into view in the grounds surrounding the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook site in southwestern Colorado, and then be bumped back. So that is the farthest, and I know that's the farthest I went to the future because, in point of fact, it's one of the only times I went to the future. I went there several times to gather microfilm summaries of intervening events. Essentially, we were giving the U.S. Defense Department the history of the future.
Wow.
And so there weren't many probes to the future, either via Chronovision or teleportation.
So for all those people that are concerned about 2012 and the end of time and the Mayan calendar, we do continue on into the future.
Well, in fact, this is the American landscape that I, as best as I could discern it, from popping into view in 2045 and walking across this sort of industrial park area with people going by on their Segways, you know, Dean Kamen's device, you know, his invention,
wow,
the HIT. There were actually people going by, because I remember telling my dad when I got back from one of those probes, what are those things those people are standing on that look like lawn fertilizers? you know, that's what it looked like to a kid from, you know, suburban New Jersey. Those devices they have by then just get around, like where they're working in a facility like that. And so there are people going by on the front of the building on Segways. I thought that was kind of disorienting to see that. But we would go inside the building and get microfilm scrolls and then take them back. And I'm telling you, from what I was able to see, the American landscape that was represented at that setting was essentially in a steady state ecology. It was like a garden city in full bloom. It was a beautiful environment. So for those who are trepidatious about 2012 and what the future holds, I can confirm that the 2045 that I visited was a beautiful place, and that people were prospering and involved in very, creative and technically sophisticated activities.
Wonderful. Well, that's really good news.
Yeah.
Now, you went to some other places too, and I'm just dying to ask you about your time. You've been at least once, right, to one of our local planets, to Mars. There's a base on Mars.
Correct. There's at least one base on Mars because I was in it. But essentially what happened is I did a lot of teleporting back and forth between New Jersey and New Mexico when I was in Pegasus.
Mm.
I would say at least 40 times. Because
wow.
They were essentially trying to arrange these things and sort of dovetail them into our ordinary childhood. In fact, I had a wonderful childhood. I have no regrets. I had a fantastic childhood just of a normal nature outside the project. I've lost my train of thought here. What was your
question?
Mars.
Well, anybody would give their left tooth to go to have the experiences that you've been able to have.
Right. Actually, yeah, you asked about Mars. I didn't really want to go there, and so actually I viewed it as somewhat of an intimidating prospect, just the idea of being on another planet. What happened was the project activities ended formally in 1972. Now, we had access 1973 from fall of 71, but on my, alpha timeline in New Jersey, Pegasus kind of ended by the time I left the summer after fifth grade. And then our family moved to California, and for those 6 years of junior high and high school, I had no intervention by the federal government in my life, scientific, intelligence, military, or whatever. I was supposed to go to the Naval Academy, but declined, because they were going to, as we learned from the defense attaché, attached to Project Pegasus, Donald Rumsfeld, they were going to have all the kids, or at least some of the kids, go through the Naval Academy as a context for involving them in later project activities. But I decided I didn't want to go to the Naval Academy because I didn't want to basically be in the regimented world of the military or intel community again, because there were some negative things serving in that context that I experienced as a kid that just didn't make it a very palatable option for me. However, I did have a couple interventions that related to the government attempting to correct things that had happened to me when I was on Pegasus. I had a few teleportation experiences around 1980 just to correct some of the quantum displacement in my life that had resulted from a mishap that happened when I was on the project as a kid in 1971. But to explain that, we have to go into a pretty arcane discussion of quantum physics. But essentially what happened was, in 1980-81, they placed a CIA agent in my life by the name of Courtney M. Hunt. Now, Hunt's identity has been verified by a prominent ethicist who works with U.S. intelligence and military agencies, a scholar by the name of Dr. Jean Maria Arrigo, and also a whistleblower who was, in fact, the Army security attaché to Project Pegasus, a U.S. Army captain by the name of Ernest Garcia, who was involved in many illustrious projects like this for the U.S. government. And they placed Hunt in my life in 1980-81, as a kind of a channel to the CIA. He wasn't handling me, but he was sort of briefing me, training me on some things that were coming, but essentially somebody that was sort of a mentor that I could ask questions about how the U.S. intelligence community works. And throughout the summer of 1981, Hunt kept plying me with a question that I really didn't even want to hear him ask, and that was, so what's your answer? Do you want to go to Mars? And I finally said, Courtney, it's not that I don't want to teleport anymore. It's basically I don't want to go off planet. It just doesn't seem like a very hospitable.
It's spooky.
It's spooky. I mean, are my feet going to stay on the ground there? I remember initially asking him, how am I going to get there, via rocket? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He says, you know how we get people places, So we ended up having a lot of discussions that summer, like, look, are you going to go or not? We want you to go to Mars. And I finally said, why should I go? And he said, because the survival of the human race depends upon it.
Really?
And I thought about it, and I thought, well, if I'm even destroyed in the process of teleporting to Mars, at least I'm doing it for the right reason, and so I agreed to go.
Okay.
And one day there in the sort of mid to late summer of 1981, he drove me to a CIA facility in El Segundo, California. We went up an elevator right in the front of the building, and got out on about the fifth floor.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked in across the floor to a big counter in the middle of that floor. There was just one person working there. And he knew Courtney, and they kind of laughed that he was back at the building.
Hmm.
And he gave them my name, and he said, okay, Andy, you can walk into the teleport now. And I said, where is it? And I was expecting these two parentheses-shaped objects on the floor or some big Stargate device where there was nothing around you when you teleported, like the experience I had had as a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old. And he said, he laughed, and he said, it's the elevator that we just came up in.
Oh, my goodness.
Really? He said, yeah, Scout's Honor, so why don't you get in the elevator?
Wow.
And so I stepped into the elevator, and he wasn't going with me on this particular probe, my first probe up to Mars. And the door closed, and it went up about three stories up to the eighth floor of the building.
Uh-huh.
And I heard Courtney's voice through the intercom say, are you ready? And I said, yeah. And then a couple more minutes passed, and he said, are you really ready? And I got kind of exasperated and impatient, and I said to him, light this candle. And he basically said, okay. He laughed, and he had a very kind of gruff, you know, sort of hardcore sense of humor, like a lot of career intelligence people.
Right,
you know,
right.
A real laconic sense of humor. And he laughed, you know, ruefully. And essentially, everything seemed normal, except I imagine what would have been halfway to Mars. It seemed to be halfway during the transit. There were some spatial effects that occurred in the elevator. The elevator, which had been rectilinear in shape, mm-hmm. kind of got a little bit more oblate, and there was this tremendous pressure.
Mm.
And there were some sensations of disorientation and pressure that I didn't experience when I was jumping through the Tesla device at Curtis Wright when I was a child.
Uh-huh.
And I think there must have had to have been, because the whole room went there. This wasn't jumping through a teleporter that opened up a vortal tunnel in time-space. The room uh-huh. itself went with me to Mars. And
wow.
these are the so-called jump rooms that researchers like David Wilcock have been writing about.
Uh-huh.
So what happened is, after these weird sensations and perceptions abated, and I still found myself in this elevator, it opened up, and as Courtney Hunt had described, I was in an underground facility that looked like a big sort of concrete bunker area, like maybe one of the service areas that you would find around a big, you know, Major League Baseball field. It was sort of one story below ground and just this cavernous expanse of concrete, like if you were in some part of a major dam where you have workrooms and stuff to maintain the dam. And, you know, in other words, it was an industrial site. It was totally unfurnished, just this big underground concrete facility.
Okay.
Like the deep underground military bases that people have reported, and some of which
that we've heard about.
Right. Which do exist.
Yeah.
And as Hunt had instructed me, I walked up a concrete stairway up on the right side of this cavernous room where the elevator had opened. And as he had described, the access point to the surface of Mars was provided by the eyes of a skull-like sculpture that was sitting on the surface of Mars.
Wow.
So I went up into like this dugout area, and then I could see the eyes of the sculpture from behind, from being inside the skull.
Mm-hmm.
And I clambered up onto the eye sockets and through the skull, and I found myself on the surface of Mars, which looked a lot like Sedona, Arizona. It has sort of a rust-red terrain, a light blue, a very pale blue atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one individual there to greet me. And about 5 minutes after I arrived, two more individuals showed up, so that there were three up there. Two men and a woman about my age, maybe a little, maybe a couple of years older. I was 19 in 1981. So they seemed 21, 22, 23 perhaps.
Mm.
And they did not have crystal helmets with respiration devices in them. Like
okay, you were wearing, you had full gear.
Yes, Hunt had shown me. I think what it was Hunt had shown me how to use the helmet. You know, he's going to put it on, and in fact, I wasn't in a suit, so the helmet closed off around my neck or shoulder area.
Okay.
And then I'm yelling through the microphone at them, can I take my helmet off? I'm thinking, are these people Martians, and can they breathe this atmosphere? Why did Courtney give me a helmet? So they were laughing, particularly the one I was interacting with, and I took my helmet off, and I could breathe the atmosphere of Mars. It was difficult.
Wow.
But I didn't start hyperventilating. The best way I can describe it is, if anybody has spent a hot summer day in a smoggy city like Los Angeles at its worst,
yeah.
and your lungs are aching by about 7 o'clock at night, maybe you've been swimming all day,
yeah.
and you have smog lung, and it's difficult to breathe.
Yeah.
It was sort of like that. I felt a little bit lightheaded, and yeah, and like I was struggling to breathe somewhat, but I could breathe the atmosphere of Mars.
Okay.
And they had become accustomed to it. So on that first trip, I essentially stood around with them for about a half hour or so outside this skull-like sculpture on the surface.
Wow.
And then I went back in and went down to the elevator, and about 45 minutes later, the elevator door closed, and I found myself back in El Segundo after about 10 minutes.
Wow. Now, who were the people that were with you at that time? I mean, were they other human life forms, or were they? Did you meet life forms that were indigenous to the Martian planet?
Well, the three people at the immediate area in front of the skull there on that first trip were human beings like you and I from Earth.
Okay,
they were Mars staff of the CIA stationed there.
Okay.
Now, the second time I went up with Courtney Hunt, and we walked around the surface for 3 or 4 hours. And I did, in fact, encounter on that trip, nobody was there to greet us, so he walked over to this building, which was like this old adobe, sort of, again, southwestern-type construction. And when we walked onto the yard of that property, sort of the xeriscape landscape of that property, over on the left side of the house was something initially that I thought was a dog. But what it was, in fact, was a creature that had the bald head and sort of muscular shoulders of a Caucasian male, hybridized with lower extremities that were sort of grub-like. And when we entered the property, he came bounding across the property at us, kind of snarling like a human and barking like a dog at the same time.
Wow.
So much so that I actually sort of just instinctively stepped behind Hunt because I thought he was going to bite us. And got within 3 feet of us. Hunt kind of moved towards him quickly to startle him and scare him away, and he turned heel and went bounding away, wailing baffly like a dog, as if Hunt had wounded him by scaring him. And then Hunt turned to me and said, "He's harmless." We then entered the house. Actually, the screen door fell off when Hunt opened the door. It was all rusted and just literally fell off in his hand. And he kind of laughed, ironically. And inside the building was a Mars colonist or explorer, somebody from CIA who had clearly been up there for months or years, who was essentially insane. I mean, he was basically suffering from exposure to the point where he had pretty much lost his mind. Mm-hmm. And when we entered the room, he started essentially evading Hunt all over the room. I think he thought he was going to be assassinated. He was definitely intimidated by our presence in the room. Maybe he didn't recognize us at first as U.S. personnel. And he thought perhaps we were some other life form that might take his life. But he was panicking, pretty much falling all over this one-room apartment, house, trying to evade us. And Courtney calmed him down, and he began babbling almost nonsensically about the people on the project who had been lost. For example, he described how one of the personnel had been eaten by the plesiosaurs that roam the surface of Mars. These are these reptiles that are sort of Loch Ness monster-shaped creatures that are carnivores, just like they were on Earth before they became extinct after the K2T extinction event on Earth.
Wow!
So I had interaction with this was a human person who had been placed up there by the CIA who was pretty much in a state of real psychiatric imbalance from having been up there so long, enduring the conditions and the dangers of being there. And then we walked out of his place. He asked Courtney whether he could go back with us, and Courtney said, "Not on this trip. I've got to take Andy back."
Uh-huh.
So he was very, very dejected about that. Then we walked around, and I don't remember exactly the life forms we encountered because those parts of my memories are still buried, but I do remember that when we then stopped and started walking back to the skull so we could go into the underground facility and take the jump room back to El Segundo, there were like 6 or 7 seal-like, half human, half grub-like creatures up on a hillside that were sort of barking like walruses as I was walking past them, kind of like, "Wow." And I said to Hunt, "What does that mean?" And he said, "They're saying goodbye to you."
Wow.
So some of the life forms were actually interacting, trying to communicate with me up there.
Wow.
And then we went back, and we got within about 40 feet of the skull, And I saw that a boulder on my right had moved. And then it was at about 30 feet from the skull, I saw this periscope-like neck and small head come up with an eye on it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I turned to Hunt, and I said, is that an animal? And he said, yes. And I said, we stepped a few more feet towards the skull, and I said, is it a predator? And he said, afraid so.
Ooh.
And then we stepped a couple more feet towards the skull. And he said, I tell you what, Andy, when we get to about 10 feet from the skull, I want you to run like hell and then dive through the eye sockets like you're coming into home plate in a baseball game to try to win the game.
Oh, because, my God.
You are, okay? And so we got within 10 feet, and he said, let's go, and we ran like hell, and I saw the thing closing on me in sort of my right field of vision. And as we dove through the eye socket of the skull, this plesiosaur-like creature, it was a very bulbous one, smacked its whole body against the eye socket of the skull. It didn't recognize, you know, what the object was, which is, I think, why they disguised these access points to their underground civilization with what looked like rocks that human beings can identify as skulls or faces or whatever, because intelligent humanoids can identify that they can get access to the underground civilization through those points, but the less intelligent but obviously predatory creatures on the surface of Mars don't really know what they're looking at. So we kind of righted ourselves inside the eye socket there. I looked back quickly to see if it had gotten through the eye socket. It hadn't. We began to scamper down the stairwell, and I said to Courtney, is it a meat eater? And he said, you betcha, that thing had teeth all down its throat.
Oh, my God.
So I had contact not just with, you know, non-predator species on Mars, but, in fact, a predator species chased us back to the skull.
Well,
now that
about...
may have been a simulation of some kind, but I think it was actually a real, you know, a real risk that we
it certainly sounds that way. Now, what about higher life forms or higher intelligence? Are there higher life forms that you were made aware of?
Well, this comes from different sources, and not my two very brief trips up to Mars in 1981. At that. What I can confirm about Martian life, well, first I'd just like to say that my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, which I published last year, is the first work of science to prove that Mars is an inhabited planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I would urge your listeners to visit exopolitics.com and click on that paper that I published on December 12th of last year, because there's ample evidence in that paper of the humanoid creatures, the animal life forms, as well as the... carved statues and built structures that humanoids have designed all over the surface of Mars.
Mm-hmm.
But separate and apart from that recent publication, when I was attached to Project Pegasus as a child, my dad and I went over to Curtis Wright again, not to teleport to Santa Fe, but they said there were some Martians over there and they wanted to meet me.
Mm.
They said they're leaving after their last trip here and they know about you and they want to meet you. And I really couldn't get my head around what he was talking about, Martians. And he finally said, son, they're human beings like us, but they're from Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over to one of the hangars at Curtis Wright, and we went into a small meeting room with these three, essentially, gentlemen who looked very, very human. I've described them as essentially bald, ugly white guys. And the three of them looked like any combination of four Three Stooges.
Oh, interesting.
They were bald. One had a small amount of hair around his balding pattern. And they were essentially completing their shop talk there with the Curtis Wright personnel.
Whoa.
And then they got up and walked past me into their ship, which was this small silver teardrop-shaped ship that had been hovering by the side of the stage-like loading ramp there in that hangar when we walked in from that side. And one of them, the last one, as they walked past me, stopped and said, my dad, he said, it was a privilege visiting your beautiful planet again and seeing you again, Ray. Thank you for introducing us to your son, Andy. And my dad very graciously said, well, it was great to see you guys again. I hope we can get together next time you visit our planet. And they walked in a kind of a strange way. They didn't walk exactly the same way as modern humans. And also their musculature was allocated in different parts of their body in a way that wasn't exactly analogous to modern human beings. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
They were dressed in silver spacesuits with a red, sort of a blood-red crest on the chest with a yellow lightning bolt in it. That was sort of the spacesuit that they were wearing.
Wow.
And they got into this rather small craft. It was about the size of a compact automobile. It was very small.
Huh.
And they puttered across out of the hangar, and we watched them. We stepped down the same steps from the stage level to the floor level there within the hangar. And we allowed their ship to go out to the tarmac, so we followed it about 100, 200 feet behind them. And then the engineer standing on my right said to me, "Now watch this, Andy." And the Martians took their ship in a big circle on the tarmac and then took off horizontally and then vertically, going from like 40 miles per hour to, I would say, 4,000 and then 8,000 and then 12,000 miles per hour in the blink
Lord.
Of an eye. It was the most remarkable technical feat I've ever seen, even as someone who teleported for DARPA. So I do know that I can confirm that not only are there humanoids on Mars because I've published pictures of them that have resulted from my own photo analysis of pictures from Mars photographed by NASA and the European Space Agency, but because I met three of those essentially human Martians at Curtis Wright in 1970.
Wow.
But then we also have the fact that there are more ET-like humanoids that also coexist on Mars with that race of humanoids, and there are pictures of some of those beings in my papers. So
wow.
We have now both direct eyewitness testimony that I'm providing and photographic evidence from the world's leading space agencies of these humanoid species on Mars. And I think that now that we have direct evidence that the planet that every 2 years comes closest to our planet, that is essentially our neighboring planet, that we have to begin the dialogue in law and policy to determine what we're going to do about that fact. How are we going to interact even more extensively with that civilization?
Oh,
how
absolutely.
Are we going to visit Mars and protect its environment? These are all discussions that we haven't held on Earth, and we need to start holding. And that's
Reason why. We've hardly been able to have the discussion about how we're going to protect our own planet.
Exactly, and here we have a situation where we're affecting the civilization and the environment of a neighboring planet, and we don't even have a consensus as a people on this planet that we're interacting with a neighboring planet. And I consider that a very dangerous situation to be in.
Yes.
I'm calling for full disclosure of the Martian presence on Earth and the Earthian presence on Mars.
Yep.
And I'm also going to be calling for distinguished public servants who are aware of what Project Pegasus achieved to come forward and join me in a press conference at the National Press Club to reveal what they know about the secret teleportation capability that the U.S. government achieved over 40 years ago. And those
what do they have today? if they had that 40 years ago, as we know that they've got, just about everything imaginable. It boggles the mind what kind of technology has sped through the, through the quantum foam and is, here and accessible without our knowledge.
Absolutely. And, because we know they had, and I participated in it, and others are now coming forward. Project Camelot has interviewed Arthur Newman about his teleportations to Mars for the National Security Agency. So there are other whistleblowers besides myself now coming forward.
Oh, yes. What you're saying is backing up what Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra have been discussing about NASA, trying to get the information out that there are not only artifacts, but there are actual constructions on Mars.
Absolutely. I feel so cosmically privileged not only to be able to be an individual, principally associated with the public revelation of what's on Mars, but also to stand on the shoulders of giants like Dick Hoagland and Mike Barra, who have been working for 30 years to articulate the fact that there are artificial structures on Mars. There's really a rich history in this area. This is really a tradition that goes all the way back to Schiaparelli and Lowell at the end of the 19th century. We now have over 100 years of a tradition in natural history and science that now convincingly establishes that Mars is inhabited. And we have to start figuring out what we're going to do about that more intelligently.
Absolutely. And to start taking it seriously and not treat all of this as something to laugh at or poo-poo or discard completely. We need to start opening our minds to what is so that we can, move forward, because this is one of those turning points in our evolution, in humanity's evolution, that happens, you know, only so often, maybe every 26,000 years.
So I would say that's true. I look at it as, I think if that we don't do the right thing about Mars, if we don't engage another inhabited planet correctly, we're not going to pass our final examination of cosmic citizenship. How can we say that we have a right to explore, to travel to and explore distant star systems if we don't even do the right thing regarding one of our celestial neighbors? So Mars is a critical test case. If we can construct the most intelligent, efficacious regime in law and policy to really show concern and protect the civilization and ecology of Mars as we begin visiting it more extensively, then perhaps we'll have a right to go on and explore the cosmos, but not before then.
Well, Andrew, can I ask you this question? Aren't there some pretty self-interested forces that are trying to keep all of this suppressed and use it for their own benefit?
I think there are. Clearly the permanent secret government, what you might describe as the military-industrial intelligence complex, which you might describe as the intelligence community, still has a policy of concealing these technologies and the secret space program that they gave rise to. I was going to say that I'm going to be calling for two Project Pegasus principals to now step forward and join me in revealing the fact that teleportation was achieved over 40 years ago. And I'm going to do it in a bipartisan manner. I'm going to ask a prominent Republican public servant and a prominent Democrat public servant to step forward. And that would be Donald Rumsfeld, who twice served our nation as defense secretary, who was the defense attaché. He was the point man between the Pentagon and the project principals on Project Pegasus.
Wow.
We shared many lunches and dinners with Don when my father and I were on the project. We held him in high regard, and I'm going to be calling on him to step forward at a minimum to reveal the teleportation technology so that we can use it to advantage all of humanity. I'm also going to be calling on Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico, who served as a young staffer on the project. Bill was doing the head count when we began teleporting as a group of children to the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds in the summer of 1970. He also was held in very high esteem by the project. In fact, the project had determined, using its quantum access capability, that Donald Rumsfeld was destined to be defense secretary and that Bill Richardson was destined to be governor of the very state where most of the project activities were occurring in.
Wow.
So I think they should be proud of what was accomplished in that project, and I think that they are intelligent and conscientious individuals who will now see the value of standing tall with me and coming forward and acknowledging that while this technology maybe had to remain secret during the Cold War, the Cold War is over, and now we have to go about the activities in progressive technical development to prepare the world for the 21st century. And
absolutely.
I'm going to be calling that publicly in coming months.
Well, now, what about that's a wonderful thing, Andrew. I can't thank you enough for your courage in doing this. What about the other countries who have perhaps similar programs that are also concealed at this time? I guess we can't worry about that.
Well, I know that if their programs exist, the United States is certainly ahead of them. When I was a child on the project, and my dad and I went to Curtis Wright, where he took possession of some sensitive military plants that a military attaché there at Curtis Wright handed to him. We jumped from mid-November of 71 to the beginning of summer of 73. And I asked my dad what was in the mailing tube, and he said, sensitive military plans or secrets. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, weapon systems. And I said, what's that? And he said, you know, schematics to some of our intercontinental ballistic missiles. So in fact, the United States government won the Cold War by storing its secrets, not just in deep underground military bases in New Mexico, but deep underground military bases in New Mexico several years in the future.
Wow.
And it was in the context of those discussions that I said to my dad, I asked him, well, why are we doing that? And he said, to stay two steps ahead of the Soviets. So certainly when I was a child on the project, the United States government was several steps ahead of the former USSR. I did not hear of advances in this area by any other country, certainly none of the shop talk at the restaurant and bar level in Albuquerque. ever involve discussions of the Chinese or any other country having these technologies. And
okay.
I can also say that ultimately the governmental body that was in possession of these secrets really wasn't even the U.S. government. It was the Vatican, because it was the Vatican that had sponsored Project Pegasus and other projects like it.
Really?
My dad asked me to apply to Annapolis when I was in high school. He explained that Project Pegasus and a number of advanced research and development projects like it were ultimately commissioned by the Vatican. So I think that's how we should view it historically, is are we going to inveigh upon even Pope Benedict XVI himself?
Uh-huh.
You know, I've been thinking about asking to have a papal audience and ask him to help liberate these two technologies to advantage the human race.
Mm-hmm.
One, to solve our transportation problems and remove all those pollutants from transportation.
Mm-hmm.
The other, to focus on very positive things that have happened in human history. You know, think of how inspired you are when you see, let's say, Dr. King giving the I Have a Dream speech.
Oh,
well,
my
we can
goodness.
Be inspired that by that because we can view it. Well, what about the events in human history, like, let's say, the signing of the U.S. Constitution or Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address? We can only read about those great events in history.
Right.
But if we
right.
had chronovision, you know, if we had a protectorate under the United States government or the U.N., and you had a protectorate that did not invade people's privacy, but went back and captured critical, you know, key inspiring moments in history,
wow.
imagine the positive impact that would have on civilization.
Wow.
So
yeah.
I think that's the historical or political context in which we have to view the development of these technologies. They were originally commissioned by the Vatican, and the United States government was far in advance of any other national government at the time of their emergence.
Wow.
Presumably still is.
This is amazing information, Andrew. I must say you are one of the most interesting guests I've ever had on my show.
Well, thank you. Thank
and, you know, we've literally run out of time. It feels like we've been chatting for a second or two. I could just ask you questions all night long, so I hope that you'll be willing to come back again and continue this discussion so that we can help bring this information to light and maybe help make your dream come true.
Well, I certainly would be happy and honored to come back and just tell me what day you'd like to have a conversation again. I'll be happy to appear on your show again. I would like to point out to your listeners that my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, it's related to the time travel experiences mm-hmm. that I've just described in the sense that I was permitted to read that paper in 1971 as a result of the U.S. government having it. And so your listeners can read that paper and about 40 other research papers about life on Mars that I've published at www.exopolitics.com. And also on Facebook, I started a Facebook group called The Discovery of Life on Mars. So I would invite your listeners to get onto Facebook and join that group.
And what's the name of that?
That is all under the heading of The Discovery of Life on Mars. It's actually
okay.
a group. Where individuals who support the Mars Anomaly Research Society that I founded and am the president of, they can follow our activities, our research activities at Mars, because I've posted links to all the papers at Exopolitics there.
Wonderful.
So
wonderful.
That's a way to just shoot right through to the Mars material. I'd definitely like to come back and...
Yes.
Are you there? I would definitely also like to come back and...
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to sign off real quickly.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case, that's where my Mars writings are, and they'll see that I've also started to reveal information about Pegasus in that context. So I would urge your listeners to join Facebook and join both my personal Facebook site and then the Discovery of Life on Mars.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrew, for being on the show. I will have you back very soon. And thank you for your courage and for sharing such a powerful information with the listeners.
Well, thank you for having me, Lance. I look forward to being on your show in the near future.
Absolutely. It's been a great pleasure. And thanks to the listeners. And good night, everybody, and have a great evening. Bye-bye.